This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Gareth Porter, whom you've heard many times in Takes on the World, is an independent investigative journalist and historian who has been writing on U.S. national security policy since the Vietnam War. His articles can be found on Truthout, Antiwar.com, The American Conservative, and Consortium News, among other publications. His important book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, was published in February 2014. Today, he is one of a handful of journalists who you will not hear on NPR, CNN, or MSNBC, nor see quoted in the mainstream media, who have attempted to defuse the drive for regime change in Iran and expose the hawkish elements surrounding President Trump, who mouths their propaganda, as well as Russiagate. Well, welcome once again, Gareth Porter, to Takes on the World. Let's start off with getting your take on the Mueller report.
Yes, in the
past, we've discussed the lack of substance and the allegations made about the extent of Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Has the Mueller report done anything to change your mind?
No, not really. I mean, there's no major revelations in the Mueller report that change what many of us have been saying for some time, which is that they did not have the evidence on which to base this campaign that has really inundated the viewers and readers of news in the United States for a couple of years now. There are some telltale points in the report which I think are worth pointing out, but really there's nothing in this report that is going to change the fundamental judgment that I and many others have reached that the FBI and other national security and intelligence agencies was really embarked on a witch hunt here that had political ramifications, not just political ramifications, political motivations, and was really a massive distraction from the reality that the American people really needed to focus on. What I would say to begin with about the Mueller report is that although Mueller's investigators did not find anything that would provide the basis for any legal action against the people who they investigated on the basis of their contacts with Russians, and they admit that very clearly, what it did do was to word the executive summary of the report in such a way as to make it possible for those who have been holding on to this conspiracy theory for a couple of years to continue to press their campaign. They use wording, as I point out in the piece that I've just written. It hasn't been published yet, but will be out in Truthout very soon this week, I think. What I point out is that the wording of the introduction to the executive summary of the report is done in such a way as to lead one to be able to suggest that there are still very suspicious things surrounding the contacts between campaign personnel and Russians, or people who are said to have been somehow representing the Russians. And for example, WikiLeaks is considered to be somehow a Russian tool in the Mueller report, as well as this guy, Mifsud, Professor Mifsud, who is, if anything, more in the camp of Western intelligence than in the Russian camp. So there is a lot of misleading here in the way it's been presented. I argue in my piece that the way the executive summary is worded, it makes it clear that Mueller intends to continue to play an active political role in appearing before congressional committees, and that role will not try to squash the campaign of leaks of insinuations of the past couple of years, but will in fact locate him in between those people who carried out that campaign and people who have said all along or who've concluded that there was really no substance to those allegations.
Well, you know,
so that's the first point I want to make about it.
Go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, the other thing that I would point out that I found most interesting about the report, not a complete surprise to me by any means, is that the Mueller report does not actually claim to have real intelligence or hard evidence to support its claim that the Russians did in fact carry out the hack of the DNC and transferred those emails to WikiLeaks. In fact, what they have done is it's not a surprise to me, but I think it's important to understand this. What they've done is to pin their case on entirely, or to base it entirely on the legal document that they have cited in the past, a document that is called the Netikcho, document, indictment, I should say. And in that, they point out that the evidence shows that the Russians used the same devices, the same approach in terms of technology in carrying out this hack that they used for other operations by the GRU, and including operations that they say resulted in an attempt to hack into U.S. state-based electoral sites. And I've, of course, basically refuted, debunked that claim very explicitly in an article that I published last year. But they have continued to claim that the GRU carried out this hack. And what the document that they claim really reveals is that this was based, this entire conclusion was based on an inference by analysts and nothing more. And I make that claim based on the fact that the NSA had a document which was supposedly showing that the GRU carried out a hack, an attempted hack on electoral websites. And to make a long story short, what the article, this was in the covered in The Intercept, what the article on that NSA document showed was that, in fact, there was nothing more than an analyst judgment that the GRU was behind the hack that they were talking about. So I think one can now be very clear, whereas before we were not so clear, about what they did or did not have in the way of evidence to support the accusation about the Russian hack. And by the way, I mean, I am completely open-minded about whether the Russians, in fact, did carry out this hacking of the DNC and of the DCCC in 2016. I think it's entirely consistent with their capabilities as well as with the motivation, which surely the Russian government and Putin in particular must have because of the fact that the United States government intervened, meddled, if you will, in the 1996 Russian presidential election, which got Boris Yeltsin elected, despite the fact that at the start of the campaign in 1996, his approval rating, his popularity was so low that nobody believed that he could possibly win. And the only way he won was that a team of American electoral experts was brought in and gave him expert advice, including polling advice and advice on messaging and other things, and managed to pull him out of this basically losing position that he was in, a completely losing position, and he edged out his his closest rival, 54% to I guess 46%. So this is by way of saying that I think it's entirely possible, if not likely, that the Russians did pull off something like that. But, you know, the fact is that the FBI and the CIA and the others did not have the evidence, and they acted as though they did. And so I think that's what really should be of concern to Americans at this point.
Well, it's interesting. The U.S. not only did not try to hide the interference of both with the approval of Bill Clinton by Republican professional election engineers, the Time magazine put Boris Yeltsin on the cover with an American lapel pin. The United States bragged
right.
about that role, and yet I've yet to hear a single word on NPR or from Rachel Maddow.
Right.
Actually, I don't watch her. I have to admit, I can't stand her. But not a single U.S. media outlet has brought up 1996. This is critical because, obviously, the Russians are well aware of it.
Yes, indeed.
Excuse me. What also gets me is that apparently both Republicans, or certainly the Democrats, believe that releasing the information about the chicanery and the double dealing of the Democratic National Committee in its attempt not only to sabotage Bernie Sanders' candidacy, but also to promote Trump's, which before I called you, there was a meeting 5 years ago today, the Democratic National Committee, before Trump had even said he was going to run, announced for running, that they wanted a Trump-like character, either him, Ted Cruz, or Ben Carson, to run a more extreme right candidate, the better to
right.
push the Republicans to the right. And at the same time, the Washington Post was reporting that Bill Clinton was talking to his good buddy, golfing buddy Donald Trump, to get Trump more active in Republican politics. And I don't think that's a coincidence, but what do you think about that?
Well, I think that makes sense, of course. And I think that it is important to understand just how completely the media and the intelligence community connived to present this this Russian, assuming for the moment that the Russians did in fact turn the WikiLeaks documents over, the documents over to WikiLeaks, that this represented a dire threat to American democracy. This is one of the great misleading themes that has been put forward by the powers that be in this country over the last couple of decades. This clearly is the heart of the case that has been made, that it is an awful thing for American democracy to have the WikiLeaks publish the secrets of the Clinton campaign, how they basically cheated Bernie Sanders during the primary season in the Democratic Party's primaries, and that the reason is that it came from the Russians. Well, you know, this was a perfectly legitimate news story that every single news outlet in the country regarded as such, and it was an important story in terms of holding accountable people in American politics to a standard of truth telling and of being accountable for their efforts to tilt the scale unfairly within the political process. So it's really, I think it's fair to say, it was a story that was necessary to right wrongs that were important to political reform in American democracy. So, I mean, that is an argument that needs to be totally refuted and absolutely rejected in American politics. And until that happens, I'm afraid we're going to be still headed down the wrong road.
Well, certainly, it appears that those who were responsible, beginning with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for the head of the Democratic National Committee, who had to resign, otherwise paid no real price for what they had done. Donna Brazile had given Hillary Clinton the questions ahead of time before her debate with Sanders. She had to apologize, but essentially, they paid no price. And what it seems to be worse is the Democrat voting block of the public, those who supported, let's say, Hillary Clinton, did not demand investigation or that those who had actually tampered with our elections, not the Russians, but the Americans, and the evidence from WikiLeaks, every document has been authenticated. No one has challenged any of those documents. Right. There has been no outrage, comparable outrage, by any real sector of the American public about that, Democrats or Republicans.
Well, Jeff, you've put your finger on really the fundamental problem that we face here, which is that in 2016, we had an election that was held in the context of a political system that had really lost lost most of its legitimacy in the eyes of large parts of the electorate because precisely of the lack of any responsibility of accountability that had been going on for many, many years. And so you have, abuses of power that had been taking place without any mechanism for trying to right those wrongs. And I think that's really the backstory behind the 2016 election. And that's why Julian Assange and WikiLeaks play such an important role in trying to move the move things back towards some degree of accountability. And this is really the issue that I think is going to have to be fought out in the coming months over the Russiagate and the issues surrounding it.
Well, I don't see this ending. The Republicans apparently, or at least some Republicans, are going to try and push an investigation in the Senate into the use of this so-called Steele dossier. Maybe you explain that after I ask the question. As a basis for a FISA warrant to spy on the Trump campaign, and they're going to launch their own investigation. So we're probably, it seems like we're going to have the Democrats doing their investigations and the Republicans doing theirs from the other side, which is likely to take us into the 2020 election. Maybe comment on that. My guest, by the way, is Gareth Porter, award-winning investigator, journalist, and a frequent guest on Takes on the World.
Well, first of all, on the Steele dossier, I mean, I think so much has been written about that and revealed about it by now that the Mueller report really, I think, is the final sort of blow to it. The Mueller report clearly does not accept anything about the Steele dossier. Nothing from that dossier has really entered into the record that it used in its accounts. I think it's beyond question that the Steele dossier was a political job done for money that had no it had no integrity behind it. There was a guy who had worked for British intelligence, and some people in the CIA thought he was fine, but in fact, he had left the intelligence world, and he was now in the world of spying for money and basically finding whatever the people who paid the price wanted. And that's exactly what happened here. And so it has absolutely no value whatever, and it really does need to be studied carefully and the truth revealed to the American public, no question about that.
One of the things that occurred to me as reading what I have so far in the Mueller report is this all seems like a great basis for what we're going to see is a Hollywood movie. It's like a gang who couldn't shoot straight. If the Russians were really interested in doing this, what the Mueller report called systematic, sweeping interference in the U.S. elections, they wouldn't have a British disc jockey or a British contacting Donald Trump to arrange this famous meeting in the Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer. It just sounds so clumsy. Or have various Trump associates or potential Trump associates meeting with various characters around the world. It just seems not the way things ordinarily happen on an international scale. Maybe I'm being naive, but it seems like a gang who couldn't shoot straight. What do you think about that?
Well, let me tell you what I think the Mueller report helps to get a clearer vision on. That is that what actually the Russians were trying to do during the campaign, and what certain people in the Trump campaign staff were trying to do, was to make contact with one another, and to get started a dialogue. There's no question that was happening. I mean, you know, we have hints from the Papadopoulos case in particular that people on the Russian side, including people who were in touch with Professor Mifsud in Rome, or rather in London, were you know, once they had the initial contact with Papadopoulos or knew that he was trying to find contacts with the Russians, they were very eager to do that. And so there's no doubt that was going on the Russian side. On the Trump campaign side, I think it's a very interesting mix here that you had people like Carter Page and Papadopoulos who were very eager to make contact with the Russians. They thought it would be great if they could start a process that would result in a possibility of a visit by Trump to Russia to have a meeting with Putin. But these people did not have real authority in the campaign. And what you see happening over time is that the people who were running the campaign, the higher senior staff of the campaign, were only mildly open to the idea of contacts with the Russians. What they really cared about was their candidate schedule, and this was a very low priority for them. And in fact, at the first sign of controversy surrounding any contacts with the Russians, the people running the campaign said, "Uh-oh, that's it, no more, we're not interested." And so by July and August of 2016, there was no possibility of any effort to make contact between the Trump campaign and the Russians. It was all off. So, none of that really was apparent from the way the news media was covering this in 2016 and into 2017, 2018. But I think the Mueller report does have, the value of, I think, making that clearer. And in fact, this is it's even clearer once the election took place. The Russians were desperate to try to make contact with somebody in the transition team. But they couldn't do it. It was impossible. The transition team was not organized for that, and they were not really interested. So it's another story of how the reality does not connect with or the way it was covered does not connect with the reality of what happened.
One thing that's occurred to me is this all goes back to, for me, the Ukraine engineered coup by the neocons in 2014, at which point which was a Hillary Clinton, who herself is shown to be a neocon, her former press secretary Victoria Nuland, the wife of right. Richard Kagan, the founder of PNAC, they orchestrated this thing and appeared obviously to pressure Putin into annexing Crimea to maintain its only warm water port, right. and to rejuvenate NATO. They don't really care what happened in Ukraine, because his successor Poroshenko was even worse than Yanukovych and was defeated by a comedian in last Sunday's election. And that has not been the big story about what does that mean. The United States doesn't care about Ukraine. Ukraine actually means in Russian the outskirts. That's why they call it the Ukraine. In any case, it's understandable for the Russians to try and make contact with the Washington administration. And the idea we get from Democrats that it's better to treat Russia as an enemy than as a friend.
Right. And this, by the way, leads me to a point that I wasn't able to get into in this article, but that I have talked about in the past in another article, which is that there is a case historically in American political history where the person who was the national security advisor to the candidate, in this case Henry Kissinger, 1968, not only made contact with Russians during the campaign, but in fact his contact was a KGB agent and was known to be a KGB agent by Kissinger himself, somebody that he'd befriended when he was at Harvard. And in fact, Kissinger used that contact with the KGB during the campaign to begin to establish a line of contact with the Russian government, with Brezhnev. I just tweeted today, in fact, that Oleg Kalugin, the spy master, the guy who was managing the spies in the United States during the 1968 campaign, later on told about the fact that they had established a back-channel close relationship with Kissinger, and that it did, in fact, lead ultimately to much better relations between the United States and Russian government. So in 68, that did happen. Nobody really minded. It was never an issue. But in 2016, 2017, 2018, this was the scandal of the century. Now, you know, that raises the question, why was any contact with the Russians in 2016 regarded as tantamount to treason? And I think that that's a very interesting question. My own answer, very briefly, is that the difference between 1968 and 2016 is that in 1968, the United States had just was in the process of losing in Vietnam, and it was in a mood to retract, to withdraw from its role as military hegemon in the world, and that meant that basically having détente with the Soviet Union was on the agenda for somebody like Nixon and Kissinger. In 2016, the United States was not ready to end its military hegemony. On the contrary, it had gone through a period where that had become such an ideological requirement for political candidates that it was possible then for the FBI, the CIA, and the media to play this as, again, tantamount to treasonous behavior, to have contacts with Russians.
Well, I wanted to also get into Iran today, and I don't think we're going to, maybe in a couple of minutes, I'd like to get you back on for this, but what's happening in Iran, first we had the determining that the IRGC, Revolutionary Guards, was a terrorist organization over the wishes of the Pentagon and the CIA because of the jeopardy in which it would place U.S. troops. And now we have this oil deadline by the end of May 1st in which the U.S. says nobody can buy Iranian oil, but the Chinese have said we're not going to go for it. Briefly, I want to get back to you on another program on this, but what are your comments on the U.S.-Iran situation at this point, which the mainstream media seems to be ignoring?
Well, just I know we don't have any time, but just two very, very quick points. The first one is that what you've described with regard to the IRGC and most of the rest of U.S. policy toward Iran is all about Israel. I mean, it's 100% about Israel in terms of the Trump administration. There's no question in my mind about that, and I can go into greater detail at a later date on it. And the second point is that clearly, what the Trump administration's about now is the hope that they can squeeze the Iranian economy to the point where it can result in regime change. I think that they're wrong about that. I think that they're going to learn the lesson that other administrations have failed to learn, which was that the Iranian economy and political system are far more resilient than they give it credit for being. And the final point that I want to make is that from time to time you get the idea cropping up in the media, and including people who are anti-war people, that there's a new threat of war with Iran. And I have written a piece myself recently suggesting that that the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor have been pushing the Trump administration in that direction, preparing the ground for a possible war. But we now have the Secretary of State saying the United States is not going to get into a war with Iran, and I think that's the reality. I do think that a war with Iran is simply not possible for the United States for all kinds of reasons.
Gareth Porter, I want to thank you for being our guest today. I want to get back to you to talk more about that and the possibility of a false flag that Patrick Clawson of the Washington Institute jokingly recommended in a speech several years ago, which would then get the American public ready to respond. But we can't get into that now. I want to thank you for being our guest today and breaking down the Mueller report in a way our listeners, I'm sure, haven't heard anyone else do, and look forward to speaking with you again so much. So thanks so much for being our guest today, Gareth Porter, and look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care.
Glad to do it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.